Welcome to the Nonprofit News Feed, nonprofitnewsfeed.com, bringing you the best news from the best sector, news from a nonprofit perspective and what matters. This show brought to you by Whole Whale, a B Corp digital agency. Thanks for joining us. This week on the Nonprofit News Feed, closing out April with a lot of bills coming in and out of the nonprofit landscape, with nonprofits fighting on both sides of the issue. We're talking about COSA, some TikTok legislation potentially passing, and other crackdowns on civil liberties. How's it going, Nick?
It's going great, George. So as you alluded to, we want to start off the podcast today talking about a new piece of legislation that could have ramifications for nonprofits, other organizations, and is pitting nonprofits against each other, actually, as debate over the bill, over its substance, plays out in broader debates about this legislation. So the bill we're talking about is the Kids Online Safety Act, which is a new piece of legislation that aims to enhance online protections for minors by establishing a duty of care element for platforms that recommend content to young users. So the bill has broad bipartisan support and the backing of over 200 organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Psychological Association. And it would allow certain legal actions against companies if the algorithm suggests content deemed harmful to minors' mental health. Despite its broad bipartisan support in Congress, the Kids Online Safety Act, acronymed COSA, remains quite controversial due to concerns about free speech infringements and the subjective nature of determining, quote, what content is harmful. So internet freedom and civil liberty organizations like the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others argue that the bill produces free speech concerns, exemplified by the fact that what constitutes harmful content could be exacerbated by some states' attorneys general willingness to use the law to engage on culture war issues, for example. So proponents and critics have varying perspectives on the bill. And in our newsletter, we broke it out. But George, what are your initial thoughts? And then I think it could be interesting to go into some of the pros and cons here.
I mean, how much of this is just book banning 2.0? I don't want you to expose any of my children to anybody with LGBTQ associated content, because that's harmful. That's harmful to children. And I want that completely removed from your algorithm. This feels like book banning 2.0. How is it not?
Yeah, George. So I think the proponents would say, with the content moderation aspect, that the Kids Online Safety Act targets harmful algorithmic content, not specific content types. So, you know, kind of refraining from extreme content, profane content, that kind of thing. But you're right. Critics do think that the content that's harmful is actually subjective and could lead to censorship of marginalized communities. Certain LGBTQ plus advocacy organizations worry that that kind of content could be deemed harmful when the legislation is abused by stakeholders such as conservative attorneys generals, and worry about increasing government oversight over content writ large.
I think it's a very valid concern.
Yeah. And, you know, Aldrich, these organizations such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which, by the way, was one of the main, along with the Wikimedia Foundation, were some of the main advocates for net neutrality, argued that algorithmic content recommendations are protected by the First Amendment, and argue that most social media content is algorithmically ordered, and argue that this could infringe on free speech rights if the government is dictating what companies can and can't do in their algorithms. However, supporters of the bill argue that the revised bill includes exemptions for minors searching for specific content and resources from nonprofits, for example, and argue that it wouldn't censor LGBTQ plus content or sex workers, for example. Something we actually haven't talked about yet and doesn't explicitly come up in this bill is the debate around using official state credentials in the form of age verification. Age verification is a oft-cited policy policy solution to protecting kids online. But ultimately, what that kind of means in practice is that these companies, through one way or another, are going to have to verify the identity of everyone using their platform, which includes, you know, kind of surveying a extremely large database of information. And that comes with a whole host of kind of really complicated and pretty concerning rights issues, particularly for vulnerable individuals. So, George, where the bill stands now is it's quite frankly looking like it's likely to pass. The bill's gaining momentum with the support of numerous organizations. Again, it has bipartisan support. And the outcome, I think, could have pretty significant implications for how the government interacts with social media companies when it comes to content moderation policy. So I think that nonprofit organizations that engage with youth or engage on issues around free speech or civil liberties, I think you're going to start to see more about this bill as it gets closer to becoming law.
Yeah, I mean, pretty concerning. I mean, in the extreme case, like, hey, give me a picture of your ID and let us verify while also hoovering that into our database of information that we want to have on you, adding friction into products. And, you know, I think about the fact that like every single website I have to go to now, I click on a pointless, like, yes, I confirm or no, I don't confirm cookies every single time, you know, bar none. You know, I think there's particular problems when the government mandates in user experience elements that actually may end up, you know, hurting things that are unintentional. You know, going back, you know, looking at, they do define extreme content. So to take, you know, is this book banning 2.0? It opens the door a crack for sure. I don't know how far, but they define extreme content examples of things that promote addiction-like behaviors, encourage physical violence or online bullying or harassment, any sexual exploitation. They're also talking about removing any marketing to minors with regard to narcotic drugs, tobacco, gambling, or alcohol, which, you know, I think totally fair. I like those elements, but it's the parts that are unsaid that get me concerned.
Yeah, George. And we were talking just before the call, again, separate from the Kids Online Safety Act, which doesn't have the age verification requirement, but a quick search will show that a lot of states are pursuing age verification for pornography websites. I believe Kentucky just passed, the Kentucky governor added an amendment to a bill that would require these websites to verify the identity of people using them via state ID. And of course, kids should not be looking at pornography, but you get into really sticky kind of data privacy concerns with pieces of legislation like this. And, you know, porn's one thing, but if that expands to social media broadly, I think this will become a kind of a much more salient issue and instill a lot of debate.
Likely to pass, though, it seems, yes?
In Kentucky, likely to pass, it would seem. All right. Well, we can take it to our next story. And this is called From Climate Anxiety to Action. And this comes from the news organization PR Newswire. And it's talking about the Lumisphere, part of Visions 2030, which is a forward-thinking nonprofit aimed at transforming the narrative around climate change from despair to action. So this project is designed to engage and inspire communities, and it uses AI and tech to help participants envision sustainable futures and actionable solutions. George, we talked a lot about climate anxiety on the rise, and this Lumisphere experience seems to kind of try to get our creative juices flowing when we think about how we can envision a future that is more sustainable.
Yeah, moving from desperation to inspiration is exactly what environmental movements need to be doing right now to, you know, get and motivate the next generation and current generations to take the next step, throwing in the towel, using low energy communication campaigns, tactics. You know, if you imagine a matrix, you know, imagine a matrix where you've got low energy at the bottom, high energy at the top, and then negative to the left, positive emotional elements to the right. So much of the environmental tactics end up in the left side of it. So it's negative, being like, you're going to die, we're all going to die, the people who don't agree with this are dumb, like villainization, high energy, low energy side. And I think this is something that, you know, I'm delighted to see something in the top right quadrant, something that is high energy, you know, experiential and positive. Like, what, you know, what does success look like? And I, you know, celebrate Visions 2030 for trying to pull this together. And I, you know, it's obviously limited. If you're talking about an immersive installation, you got to be there to be there. But, you know, you think about what's possible more and more with VR and those experiences of saying, like, looking around at communication, like, I think there's new avenues opening up for framing and taking a shot at framing in the positive and high energy areas for the environmental movement.
Yeah, George, I think that that's exactly right. All right, I can take us into our next story. And this one comes from the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And the article is saying that, argues that inconsistent regulations and crackdown on civil liberties are hindering nonprofits. So they talked to folks over at the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University, and they're finding that a surge in state-led restrictions, legal actions against nonprofits, particularly those operating in the issue spaces of immigration, racial justice, and environmental causes, is being stifled by hostile legislation from states and potentially causing civil liberties violation issues, particularly for orgs working in these services. So, George, we were talking about this just a moment ago with our concerns about the Kids Online Safety Act and the potential ability for states' attorney generals to kind of warp what harmful content means in service of culture wars. But here, I think nonprofits themselves should also very intently be paying attention to legislation coming out of states because it directly impacts their advocacy work. You know, you got Ron DeSantis down in Florida. You have the Texas governor shipping immigrants all over the country using human migrants as like little political pawns. And, you know, it's oftentimes the organizations on the front lines of these issues are those nonprofit organizations on the ground. They're at the border. They're at the front lines of fights for racial justice and issues around LGBT rights, et cetera. So, George, I wonder what you think about this. The article says that progressive nonprofits have to navigate these challenges while finding ways to continue their advocacy. If you were an organization, what would you recommend to organizations that are being inundated, quite frankly, with a surge of legislation hostile to their missions?
It's an important note saying, like, we didn't have to go more than like 10 minutes before realizing, oh yeah, these state AGs given the power to interpret something that is threatening or very easily weaponizing the judicial system and at a state level for how nonprofits are operating. I mean, look, if you are now trying to serve a marginalized community and that marginalized community happens to include, I don't know, anything touching immigration, like suddenly you need an entire law firm backing you up, right? Like it is now part of your operating costs, apparently, to pull on a law firm. Ideally, you know, you're looking at your board composition and getting this pro bono. I've seen tremendous work come from pro bono law firms. It is actually incredible. So right now, I'd say if you are not tooling up your board member strategy and locking in that in-kind value from law firms, that might be something I put on my to-do list yesterday.
Yeah, George, and just shouting out that there's some great projects, particularly legal projects like those run by the folks over at Lawyers for Good Governance, L4GG, and all sorts of networks of pro bono attorneys, grassroots attorneys working with nonprofits all over the place to fight the onslaught of conservative, yes, legislation, but also kind of the use of the judiciary to further kind of conservative political aims. So important work. All right. I'll take us into our next story. And we want to come back to this one. This is a policy heavy podcast today. This one comes from the Associated Press, but the House is expected to vote for the TikTok ban. Actually, I think the vote did go through and did pass. And the TikTok ban got looped in with the foreign aid. I don't quite understand congressional procedures. I think the House voted on all of this kind of simultaneously, but the Senate gets to vote on each of these pieces individually. But the pieces of legislation include aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine, and the TikTok ban. Don't ask me why, but this this legislative move essentially is saying TikTok, under the new Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, Chinese-based company ByteDance is engaging in surveillance of American consumers, et cetera, et cetera. And essentially, the bill would either force the sale of TikTok to an American entity or ban it from operating within the United States. TikTok has 170 million United States users. And I think a lot of the people we know in our lives, George, who use TikTok a lot, are probably not super excited. And among those include the ACLU, who says that this TikTok ban, again, violates the First Amendment rights and the platform's significant economic and social impact. And George, I think two things can be true at once. That is, there are serious concerns about data privacy and manipulation and governance from foreign actors, foreign companies, et cetera, with undue influence over American social and political life. And that banning these apps is the absolute wrong approach and violates free speech and is just taking a sledgehammer to a complicated policy problem and just smashing the glass with any intention of picking up the pieces.
I hear the ACLU on this, and I think there's a nuance point here with regard to what is standard. Actually, look at the Communications Act of 1934. This is so heavy policy, but look, the FCC, right? There's literally like laws on the books that state that prohibits foreign ownership of more than 20% of the capital stock of broadcast, common carrier, aeronautical radios, station licenses, basically news outlets. This is something that was identified going back to like 1934. We don't want foreign actors controlling our news for good reason. I'm going to give you another stat where the current generation, the rising generation, gets most of their news, and this is from Pew Studies, from social media, from TikTok. That's where their news is coming from. I mean, if you put those pieces together, it's clear that a simple extension of not wanting news outlets that are informing our public to come from foreign actors who have their own agenda, the writing is there. This is just updating laws. Now, the thing that concerns me is the way that it is updating and a broad sweeping ability to control any website or any content on the internet and say like, oh, we want to suddenly start blocking websites because it's 20% or partially owned by a state, by a foreign actor that we now deem unsavory. Now that becomes a broad sweeping power that concerns me quite a bit. And what I see in this bill is not TikTok per se, but a broader brush being applied to any foreign ownership of this type of social asset. And that, I think, could use a couple polishing points, but this is probably going through looking at bipartisan support.
Yeah, I think that's right. Who said they would buy it? Steve Mnuchin? Gosh. I don't know, George, but to your point.
But then there's also the question, will they sell, right? So here's what happens. They get 1 year. It's not like it's going to be turned off tomorrow. It's not going to get turned off tomorrow, right? This goes through. They have 1 year to sell ByteDance, and then there's going to be an argument over the algorithm, this proprietary piece of information that they're probably not going to want to release. At some point, they probably will sell. They'll go back and forth, maybe try to ingratiate themselves to another bill to pass in time. But I think for nonprofits, if you're designing your strategy right now, I would heavily encourage diversification. If you have a large profile there, I would highly recommend diversification away from TikTok. It's part of the diet, but right now I'd say that there is a very real risk reward to leaving your entire audience built on a sand foundation as the tide comes in.
Yeah, George, I have to say, I don't understand the politics of this. being a politician voting for this ban, like, listen, the kids are going to come for you.
Oh, the kids are coming for you. Make no mistake. I actually agree with the TikTok specific push. but I don't agree with the breadth, I think, of power it gives elected officials.
Yeah. No, I think that that's fair. And, you know, we think about democracy around the world, you know, plurality, free and open internet. Other countries also don't like the influence of foreign media, whether that's American media, whether they're scapegoating certain people and actors, and, you know, it starts to get a little sticky. But George, I think we need a feel-good story. This one comes from the Salt Lake Tribune, and it is...
Got him.
I didn't read him beforehand.
He wasn't ready. I got him.
Oh, man. Kevin Bacon visits Payson High, site of Footloose, after a student campaign. So Kevin Bacon celebrated the 40th anniversary of Footloose by joining high school students and volunteers in Utah to pack resource kits for nonprofits. So Six Degrees is an organization that aims to support local communities, and the event marked the culmination of a student-led campaign to bring Bacon back to the school, blending nostalgia with a significant charity event that will distribute 5,000 charity kits to people in need. And George, fun fact, I in the fall actually met Kira Sedgwick at a charity fundraiser event, which means that I am now only 1 degree away from Kevin Bacon.
Amazing. And I've met Stephen Colbert, who has interviewed Kevin Bacon, which means I am also 1 degree separated, and I'm here for any campaign that brings the bacon back.
Got to get that bacon, George.
Great. No, that'll be taken out of context. Alrighty. I have a joke for you.
I'm ready.
So here's the thing. You know, we're all about dad jokes meet nonprofit jokes. But my question is, when does a nonprofit joke become a dad joke?
George, I don't know.
When it becomes apparent.
That's pretty funny. A little wordplay. I like it.
All right, Nick. Thanks for putting up with me. I'll see ya.
Thanks, George. See you later.
This has been the Nonprofit News Feed Summary of the Week. Thanks for joining us. As always, you can find resources at nonprofitnewsfeed.com. And don't forget to sign up for our weekly email summaries of the best news from the best sector.